Hey, lovely listeners. I wanted to give you a trigger warning and a heads up that listener discretion is advised on our next series, Victim F.
They had located the suspect of the home invasion. They were going to serve a search warrant.
Misty Carasu was still a day away from officially being a detective. But when her boss called and asked her if she'd like to go to South Lake Tahoe for one of their cases for a search, she said, sure, I'm there.
The house was your typical cabin in the woods. The house looked quiet. It didn't look like there was anybody home. We all lined up tactically and walked up to the front door.
We kicked down the door, the place was cluttered. As we make our way across all the debris, we see Matthew Mueller coming out from one of the bedrooms. And then we asked him, do you know why we're here? He said, yes.
When I went to take pictures of him, he was just shut down, didn't want to talk, just like a blank stare.
They start doing a search of the house, and Misty, from the minute she walked in, she was just getting a very creepy feeling about the place.
There were a lot of ski masks. There were a few stun guns.
We did recover a number of laptops, cell phones. There was one specific laptop that was stuffed in between the mattress and the box spring of his bed.
He was driving a stolen Ford Mustang. We opened the trunk and there was a large green bag that had a blow-up doll in it.
It was kind of stuffed in there, but it had very rigid wires that allowed it to be erect on its own. It had zip ties, duct tape, or a number of replica squirt guns. One of them had specifically just your typical pen-style laser pointer that was duct taped to it.
There were several swim goggles that were duct taped black. One in particular had a blonde hair strand attached to the duct tape. The Dublin home invasion, none of them had blonde hair.
She knows something isn't right. She knows that something bad happened to someone, but she doesn't know who.
This can't be the first time this person's done this, and she's going to find out what else Matthew Mueller has done.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, host of Crime Analyst, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service. And with me today is...
Hi, I'm Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer for CBS's Criminal Minds.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. And speaking of which, I wanted to read you a quote about our guest. This is a quote from a victim whose life they've left an indelible mark on. When we thought all hope was lost and our lives as we knew them were shattered, you stepped in and saved us. If it wasn't for your objectivity, tenacity, and determination, we don't know where we would be. And so that leads us to our very special guest today, who is?
My name is Misty Carasu, and I'm a sergeant with the Alameda County Sheriff's Office here in California.
We are so happy to have you on, Misty, and to speak with you. We know you have been so busy as well, so we really appreciate you finding some time to speak to us. And yes, Denise and Aaron both said you are their Shiro. You are amazing, a lifelong friend, and you are just incredible in terms of giving them their dignity back and investigating the case. And they believe they wouldn't be here today if it weren't for you. So huge kudos to you.
Yeah, for caring enough to go the extra mile. And even when certain people were being a little recalcitrant about doing their jobs, you actually did an amazing service, not just for Denise and Aaron and their families, but for how many other victims there would have been. And you also showed how the job should be done properly. So thank you so much for doing what you do.
Well, thank you.
We would love to hear your story, how you got involved with the case. And we're talking about Victim F. We're talking about Denise Huskins and Aaron Quinn. And just to echo what Jim said, there may have been countless victims had you not have had professional curiosity and inquiring mind. And we've been talking with them extensively and with Nikki. And the book obviously lays out everything that happened, but we're really interested to hear your POV, your point of view, and how you got involved with the case. Will you walk us back through it and take us back to that text message you received from your boss asking you to help execute a search warrant?
I remember getting a text message on the weekend, I believe it was a Saturday, from my new supervisor who was in charge of the Dublin Police Services Investigations Unit. I had just recently got into the unit as a 90-day temporarily assigned deputy to learn about investigations and take on some cases like burglaries, sexual assaults, and crimes that needed follow-up. So I got a text message from him on a Saturday that said that they needed to do a search warrant in South Lake Tahoe for a kidnap or an attempted kidnapping and a home invasion that occurred in our city. And I could either come or I could stay. And if I do go, pack a bag and be ready, like to meet us. So I told my husband that they needed me to go. And I was going. At the time, we didn't have any children. So I could just pack up.
Pick up and go.
I had my dogs, but that was it. So packed up my bags and met up with the other detectives and my sergeant. And we ended up driving to South Lake Tahoe. I got a little bit of information about the suspect, Matthew Moeller, that he was retired Marines and that they found his cell phone at the house, that they located his mother in Orangeville, California, who said that he had been staying in South Lake Tahoe at their weekend house or their vacation house. So we drove up there, got some in and out, and few hours later, we arrived. We stayed at a hotel, good old fashioned hotel with an indoor for the suspect and then the outdoor for the suspect. It was one of those hotel rooms where it had two doors. So it wasn't the safest. It wasn't at the casinos or anything fun like that. It wasn't, you know, everybody thinks it's a glamorous lifestyle that you live as a detective. No, it's budgets.
Yeah.
Stayed at the hotel. Everybody else had their buddies to stay with them because they were all male deputies or detectives. So I stayed in the hotel room by myself with my gun next to me just in case somebody came in.
Got it.
In the morning, we met with the local law enforcement agencies to muster up and talk about the search warrant and how we were going to go in and tactically force the entry into the house. So they followed us up there. It was early in the morning. It was really quiet. South Lake Tahoe, when it's off season, is pretty quiet there. It's a vacation area. So nobody was there except for like retirees who probably purchased homes and live there. When you pull up, there was no cars in the driveway. It was a long driveway. It didn't look like anybody had been there.
Was it very secluded or was it in the middle of a community?
So the South Lake Tahoe community is, they have two-way streets, but there's no, you can drive in the middle of the street because there's no like markings. And the houses, they're pretty spread far apart because there's a lot of property. You can purchase land with a lot of property. So it wasn't like a residential area. It was just more cabins.
Okay. A cabin. And this particular one, how secluded was it how visible was it from the road and so forth?
It was right off the general road next to a bunch of other houses. The only difference was other houses had cars parked in front of them, and there was no cars parked in front of this house. It looked like a vacation home. So once we once the supervisor determined who was going to, you know, stack up to force entry into the house, I was last because, I mean, I'm barely 5 foot tall. I'm brand new. I have no idea how to break into a house or use any of the breaching tools. So I was last. I want to say, was I last in the stack? I think I was last, and my lieutenant, he was the one with the key to break down to force entry because he was retiring and this was his last case and it was a huge case. So they gave him the honors of using the key to force entry. So he hit the door, I want to say a couple times. The door opened, but it was barricaded with a bunch of household items and garbage and a massage table and chairs. So you definitely knew that Matthew Mueller knew that you were coming for him. Like, he knew that the police were coming.
So was there any way to determine whether or not it was occupied, or you just didn't know?
We didn't know. We assumed he was there based off what his parents had said, but the blinds were all closed. You could tell that they were blacked out from the inside. There was no noise coming from the house. You didn't see any smoke coming from the chimney.
Explain why you think that he knew you were coming for him. I don't think that we said what the initial crime was or why you were headed out there.
So the Dublin case, Matthew Mueller came in a stolen Mustang and he parked on the street. And the way that it was set up was that there's a fire road behind this house on a hill. So he used that road to access our victim's house. He jumped the fence and he went through their back door. And he went upstairs to the parents' room, shined a light in their face, told them to do what he said so they wouldn't get hurt, and that he was there for their daughter. The dad fought back. The mom ran into the bathroom after the dad said, "Get my gun, get my gun." It was a ruse for Matthew Mueller to think that they were armed, but they had no gun at the time. So she grabbed her cell phone. She ran to the bathroom. He starts fighting with Matthew Mueller. Matthew Mueller hits him over the head with a flashlight. The dad chases him down the stairs, and Matthew Mueller is able to escape out the front door and drive away. So that is the initial, that was the Dublin case. And during this time, he had laid out his cell phone. He laid out a duct tape roll. He laid out zip ties, and he left all of that behind. So with the cell phone, we were able to call our dispatch via 911 to get a reverse caller ID to see who the phone belonged to. And it belonged to his mother.
Importantly, he said to them, "I'm here for your daughter." And was the daughter actually in the property at the time asleep?
No, she wasn't. No.
Because we had heard that he said, "Your daughter's in the next room asleep. Well, she's okay."
They had two daughters.
Okay.
They had one daughter who was, I want to say, back from college, and the other one was at college. And the one that he was looking for was the one that was at college. It wasn't the one that was at home.
So did he specifically say her name?
No, not that from what I can remember.
How did they identify that he was looking for the one that was away at college?
That I don't even know. I'd have to go back and read the police report.
Okay. But he specifically was looking for a particular aged daughter.
Yeah, I don't think that the daughter that was at home was going to college at the time. I have to go back. The Dublin case, really, I wasn't interested in. It was more what I found at the house
right. That
caught my interest. So I don't remember the specifics on that case.
But do you have any idea how old the daughter was that was actually at home? Was she younger or older than the daughter that was at college?
She was younger.
She was younger.
Yeah, okay. I'd have to go into my box and look at my
Okay.
stuff. I can email you the information.
That would be helpful. It's just useful for Jim and I to understand, because of targeting and motivation. Mm-hmm. We both have a view about what Matthew Mueller is about. And yes, it's just very interesting hearing that when he went in, that's what he said, that he was, irrespective of which daughter, that's what he announced.
When I went back, I didn't get to talk to the victims in Dublin, and then until we went back to get DNA samples from the dad. And when we went back, I went and I asked the dad, I said, "Why do you think, or how does he, Matthew Mueller, tie into your daughter?" And he said that she had gone to a university near Santa Cruz and was taking classes, you know, was a college student. And I was trying to think, well, he was over in Palo Alto, you know, committing other crimes, and he had been poaching near other universities. I was just thinking in my head that he had been poaching over near this university.
At UC Santa Cruz,
yeah. Or that he had taken a class with her, or like one of, you know, a general, not a class, but, you know, like something where you can just go and hear somebody talk with her, and had seen her and then just identified her as his next victim. That's what I was thinking, that he probably was just maybe in Walnut Creek and she was like, "Hey, I go to college here." And he was like, "Ooh, I'm a lawyer from Harvard," you know, and then he just became obsessed with her. That's my thoughts, because I couldn't figure out what the actual tie between them was.
Except what do you say, Walnut Creek? I'm sorry. Walnut Creek is very far away from Santa Cruz. And
well, it's not far away from Dublin.
Right. Okay.
So I figured like maybe she was up here visiting from Santa Cruz and she was.
Gotcha. Okay.
That's what
and, I don't want to get ahead, but, and you could tell us when we get there, but was there anything found that actually showed that he had targeted that girl, that the one that was away at UC Santa Cruz?
So unfortunately, I contacted Vallejo PD and the FBI and they came faster than we could look at any of our forensic evidence on computers.
Oh, they took it.
Oh, they took everything.
Well, let's get into that.
If I would have known what I know now, I probably wouldn't have called him right away.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I mean, that's challenging. So obviously the dad was non-compliant, as was the mom. And Mueller disappears, but you manage to find the phone, the duct ties, the tape. So the phone takes you to his home address.
Yes. We finally get to South Lake Tahoe, make entry into the house, and it's just in complete disarray. It's an open floor plan. To the left of the living room is like a master bedroom, I guess you can say. And to the right is a hallway with a bathroom and a bedroom with a washer and dryer in it. But there's boxes filled with all kinds of items thrown about the house. There's dirty dishes. There's just garbage all over the counters. And right when we walk in, Matthew Mueller's coming out of the right bedroom from the living room area. And he's compliant. By the time I made entry into the house, he had already been handcuffed. And as he's walking out of the house, there's a laptop on the floor next to the couch, which he has to walk by, and he kicks it closed.
Mm.
And so at the time, we didn't think anything of it, but that was, I think, the laptop the FBI located the sexual assaults that he recorded with Denise.
So that laptop, just to clarify, I mean, obviously it was an important thing for him. So that's his, in the act of being arrested, the thing that he focuses on is closing the laptop,
mm-hmm.
which would be an instant, for me, red flag. What's on the laptop? What's he trying to prevent you from seeing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you at any point see what was on the laptop or did the FBI take it before you actually managed to open it, see what was on it?
Yeah, the FBI took everything before I could look at anything, before I could send it out for forensics. I knew going up there that he was sophisticated. He was a lawyer. He was a Marine. He had experience. So when I went to photograph him after he'd been escorted to my patrol vehicle, I knew that talking to him was going to be not necessarily difficult, but you had to have a different strategy going into it. And that did not happen. He was immediately told, "You're under arrest. You know, we got you for this, you know, Dublin case." And he said, "I'm not talking."
That's unfortunate when people don't realize that speaking their mind can sometimes prevent thorough further investigation. And by being smart, I mean, this is something I learned very early in my FBI career, that building rapport immediately, even though, or maybe even especially because you have a strong case, that actual time period incident to arrest can be very fruitful for law enforcement if they do treat somebody with dignity and respect and don't, you know, try to, you know, shove their face in it when you still have plenty of investigating to do.
Is it like a rush of adrenaline, Misty? Like they were so amped up, and, sorry, testosteronized to like get him and get in there. And so then when they bring him out, they just want to, in his face, say, you know, we got you. Do you?
Yeah, I think like that. To me? Spot on. I think that they got super excited, like, we got our man. Well, in my eyes, it was, okay, we have this man, but that you could tell based off of everything at the Dublin house that this wasn't his first rodeo. And the way that he had barricaded himself into the house and his background, why would you, and I'm brand new, right, as a detective, but why would you just go in and show the search warrant, show the arrest warrant, and unless you're just so amped up that you're just not thinking, like, okay, yeah, we have all this evidence for Dublin, but we have to be careful because we want to talk to him and know why he picked her and what other crimes he committed.
Absolutely. And can you talk us through what else was in the house before we get into him? Because there were some other things that you mentioned, which would be great to hear from you. You had an eerie sense being in the house, but what were some of the things that made you feel uncomfortable that you saw?
So initially when I walked in, I just saw it was really completely dirty. We went to, you know, clear the house of any other potential suspects. And when we went into the room to the left, the bedroom, I noticed that there was duct tape on the windowsills as if it had been covered. There was only a fitted sheet on the bed, and on the bed there was old paper towels that were bunched up, Vaseline. Oh. And on the side of that there was a penis pump. And all of these things were adding up with the home invasion. I felt that there had definitely been something else that had gone on here, because no reasonable person would have duct tape sticking to their wall or to their windowsills and leaving their room in just such a disarray. And then as you walk through, you see that there's stun guns and there's California license plates that aren't attached to vehicles. Why do you have those? I went and searched the bathroom, and in the bathroom there was hair dye as if he was trying to disguise himself. I didn't know. There was self-tanner. There were hypodermic needles. I'm not sure exactly what they were for. I never found any like liquid drugs or anything like that. And then in the other bedroom, it just looked like a storage of just a bunch of clothing on the mat, on the bed. But just based off of all of that, and then our case, it was pretty clear to me that something else happened here. It was literally walking into a movie scene, like something's going on and you need to find out what else happened here.
And did you find goggles as well or something like that?
So in the house, I found multiple stun guns, different ski masks of some sort, lots of black gardening gloves. I found a Ford key maker for the electric key fobs that they make. So he had one of those. And it wasn't until I got to the vehicle, the stolen Mustang, that I found the goggles. And that's where I got really interested into finding out what happened prior to our Dublin home invasion.
Well, that's so great that you cared. Obviously, you know, you got the guy that did Dublin, but you also wanted to find out what the hell all this other stuff was about.
Yeah, it just didn't make sense to me unless he was very kinky and had relationships where they were involved in being tied up and wearing goggles that were duct tape black. I didn't think that that was the case in this situation because our victim was not involved with him at all.
I read that in that Mustang, Misty, that the back seats had been taken out. Is that true or am I misremembering it?
Yeah, no, it's true. We got a phone call from the local PD as we were going up there that they had found a Mustang that was registered as stolen, and it had Matthew Mueller's ID underneath the driver's side, the driver's seat. So they towed it to their lot, and then after we collected all the evidence from the house in Tahoe, we went and searched the vehicle at the tow lot, and they said that we would find a lot of interesting things in the car. So when we got there, there was no back seat, which I thought was pretty weird because the Mustang has no back seat anyways. Like, there's not a lot of room back there. So why did you need to remove it to make room? It just made no sense to me why it would be gone. And where was that back seat? Never found it. Don't know where it went. There was also receipts that he had been in Dublin and Pleasanton at the same time that our home invasion occurred. Then in the trunk was where it got even weirder or stranger. There was a large duffel bag that he had recently purchased that had the duct tape and zip ties and a bag of energy shots, like 5-hour energy shots in it. And then shoved in there was a male dummy that was dressed in a black shirt. And he had this very thick wire that was wrapped around the waist of it. So as if like he could prop it up or maybe like sit it up, that I thought was really weird.
Carpool lane, Misty.
That's what I thought. I was like, well, maybe he's just doing this to get by in the carpool. Because he's just trying to speed away. Maybe he did use it during the commission of kidnapping Denise, or actually maybe returning her to Huntington Beach as a way to get there faster by using the carpool lane. But I was like, that was just creepy. And then after you pulled the duffel bag out, there was a brand new camouflage tarp that was still folded. It wasn't in the packaging, but it was still folded, brand new. And that creeped me out because I was like, okay, well, what was he going to do with our victim? And how many other victims are there that are covered with camouflage tarps? So that caught my interest. I collected all of that. And then I continued to dig on. There were other goggles that I collected. They didn't have any hair on them or any, you know, anything I could see. And then I got to this black, I don't even know what kind of belt, nylon belt that had like a little carrying case in it. And in the carrying case was a black set of goggles with black duct tape covering the eyes. And I looked closer to take a really good photo of it for evidence. And I saw a single strand of blonde hair. And like I said, I was like, well, maybe he just dates women that like this, but I didn't think so at all. So I was like, I'm taking these. Something's not right here. We have other victims that we need to find, and we need to find them fast because we don't know if they're injured or not.
Right.
Well, thank goodness you did that. I mean, you're following your gut instincts. And I just want to say, this is serious crime that we're talking about here. It's not a laughing matter. It's not something, particularly when it comes to women, that we should ever make feel like it's low level. You're using your intuition as a woman. You're realizing that he is meant to be an ex-Marine lawyer, and yet he's living in this house that doesn't look like a house he'd bring women back to. And then you're finding all this paraphernalia, which of course is putting you on red alert. And all your instincts are saying there's something wrong here. I mean, the stun guns, the needles, the penis pump, all these things are really alarming. And I'm just so glad that the totality was what you were looking at. And it forced you to ask more questions. And I'm curious about some of your colleagues. Were they equally as surprised by what you were finding?
They weren't as interested as I was. And thankfully, as we had the search warrant, so I could take everything in plain view. They weren't interested in taking the whole entire car because I wanted to take the whole car as evidence, but it would just be too much money, I guess, to transport, to tow the vehicle back to our lot. So I fought tooth and nail to get that done. And when we got back to the city of Dublin, I actually spoke to the chief of our police department, and we were able to go back and get the car. So that was nice.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. But the guys, they just went with the flow. They just let me do what I wanted to do. And I kept telling them, you know, like, this is what I found, this is what I found. But they just were so involved in the Dublin case that they really weren't worried about the aftermath of locating other victims at that time. They did. You know, we did put out the APB net flyer to see if other agencies had anything similar. But my job as a brand new detective, I didn't have much to do except follow up on this case. And in reality, my job was to just watch hours of surveillance video from a Chevron that was down the street from our Dublin house, which was boring.
So a lot of detective work is...
Yeah. But so that's when I started just looking at everything else. I was looking at so much, like the paperwork and everything I collected, because while I'm watching this man come and buy cigarettes, this woman come and buy coffee, I was like, this is just never ending. So I started doing other things.
But that said, you cared about doing the other things, and other people didn't seem to. So we're lucky, and Denise and Aaron, of course, are lucky that you did care, and like I said, you went the extra mile. Could you tell us about this APB or flyer you put out? What did it say, and what was the purpose of it?
It just said that we had a home invasion in the city of Dublin. He came in with zip ties and duct tape, and that, you know, he was placed under arrest. So if you had any other similars in your agency, you know, feel free to contact us. I couldn't wait for responses. When I started looking up everything and I found out that he had been a person of interest over in Palo Alto and I believe Mountain View, I called them. I couldn't wait for them to call us.
Okay. And what did you find when you called them?
So I want to say it was Palo Alto. When I contacted the detective over there, he had said, you know, it's funny that you're contacting me, because I told him, I said, I have this person of interest that committed this home invasion. His name is Matthew Mueller. And he had said, it's funny you're contacting me because I have been staring at his face all of these years because I knew that he committed the home invasion in our case. I believe it was in 2009. I'd have to go back in my police reports to look at that. But I thought that was very interesting. And I'm thinking, if he had been committing crimes this long, where are the other victims? Like, and luckily,
absolutely,
five victims, but how far was he taking it with the other victims?
What case was that in 2009?
I'm going to have to look, because I know that there was two cases over in the Palo Alto area and then one in Mountain View. So I'd have to look at those police reports to actually confirm that.
Okay. So it was a break-in. I'm not sure if it was an attempted sexual assault, but he did disappear in November 2009, and his wife then filed the missing person report, didn't she? And he called her from Utah and she picks him up. So again, just the married part is interesting. And it's interesting because lots of people think that serial predators and perpetrators don't have any relationships with other women. But in fact, he did, and he was married. And the next question
BTK.
Is always, yeah, well, many others. And people always want to know about the wife, but I'm much more interested in how he presents and equally about the relationship itself rather than her as a person, because mm-hmm. she obviously has nothing to do with what he's doing. And I would imagine it was probably a shock to her and other people who knew him that he was living this double life, as it were. But this detective, I think, said to you that he really felt that it was the same person. There was DNA in one attack, but it didn't match with Mueller. And I think he had said to a number of the victims that he was intentionally leaving evidence behind to mislead law enforcement, which is also what he said to Denise, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Misty, do you know where they were living, as his wife and he, where their residence was? I mean, was it in the South Bay?
I didn't know where they were living. I think it was the San Francisco area, because I had Googled her name and tried to reach out to her and got no answer. And I left a message, but I'm sure she was just did not want anything to do with him at that time. But I Googled her name, and she was a lawyer out of San Francisco area. So I think they lived over there for a hot minute.
So there were three unsolved crimes that they believed various detectives thought that he might be responsible for. And in fact, I think, is this right, Misty, that in two of them that he forced the women to drink a substance? But I don't know what happened, you know, other than that, in terms of the detail. I'm not sure if you can remember.
Yes, he made them drink a substance of like NyQuil mixed with maybe some type of sedative to make them get drowsy. And all of this I didn't know happened to Denise. So I was just learning about all of this. And we didn't have any sedatives or find any sedatives or NyQuil in our case. And then in one of the cases, one of the victims pleads that she had already been sexually assaulted and she didn't want to be sexually assaulted again. So he had a change of heart. And he told her that he wasn't going to sexually assault her, but gave her crime prevention advice. Like, you need to get a dog, you need to lock her house. You need to get surveillance.
Power reassurance.
Very interesting. I was, when I read the police reports, I knew that he was much different than your typical burglary suspect or robbery suspect. And even like your known suspect victim sexual assault, you know, crimes that occurred. He had no business knowing any of these women except that he stalked them and he went in to sexually assault them. And he had a change of heart. I thought that was weird. The other one that he did when he sexually assaulted her, he did the same thing afterwards. He, you know, was very kind to her and said, I'm going to give you crime prevention techniques how, you know, examples of like what you need to do so this doesn't happen again. And then he told them that he was going to bleach the floors, and one of the women can smell the bleach. One woman heard water running, and he said that he was going to get rid of any evidence. He was going to plant evidence so they could never find him. And obviously they never found him.
All important information. So the fact that they weren't bungled attempts, I mean, in fact, he had interaction with them. He obviously enjoyed that interaction and that conversation afterwards. And I think it's really important what you said there, Misty. He had stalked them, and then the home invasion, that it sounds to me like they were his targets, the women. He obviously took drugs with him to sedate them, but his motivation sounds to me like it was about being a predatory stalker and about sexually violating the women. It was sexually motivated. Most likely, he didn't see it as sexually violating them or raping them. He's taking what he wants, as Jim said, power, reassurance. Well, I always think rape is about power and control anyway. It doesn't matter anything else that goes on. It is about power and control. But the fact he gives them advice afterwards, and he's now acting as like their hero of helping them and giving them advice and looking after them, this pseudo caring behavior, which of course we saw in Denise's case, but you don't know any of that at this time. You're just learning about these particular unsolved break-ins. Some of them had attempted sexual, well, one of them, I think you said, had attempted sexual assault, but the other one was a sexual assault. And then he leaves, and these cases are unsolved. But it was believed that Mueller was the suspect. Do you know how or why it was believed that Mueller was the suspect in all three?
I'm not sure in all three, but I'm sure in one of them that he was. Because when, prior to the crime occurring, the home invasion in Palo Alto, he had been a person of interest because some neighbor called and said that there was a prowler. And the police department contacted him. They, you know, filled out an FI card. He said that he was at Stanford University to teach a class, and they sent him on his way because they had nothing on him. But he had came out of the bushes when they contacted him. And lo and behold, a few days later, the home invasion happens. And so that's why the detective felt that this was his suspect. He just could never pinpoint it on him. And it's funny, like we talk about like how his behavior is. When I was doing the follow-up on our Dublin case, I watched the Home Depot surveillance video and watched his demeanor. And he walked up to the cashier. He's tall, you know, dark hair, relatively looked fit. And he had all this confidence. And he was just talking to her that you could see from the surveillance. You know, she's like giddy in the video. You can't hear what they're saying because it's obviously overhead. And then he just confidently walks out nonchalantly, like he had no cares in the world, knowing that he was going to hours later commit this crime. That was very interesting to me. I couldn't believe that I was looking at a suspect who really was, had no cares in the world because he'd never been caught, and that he was going to do it again and probably again. And he was confident, like that was his thing.
We have so much more to ask you, Misty. We're just going to have to hang on to you for just a little while longer. There's so many other questions we have about this bizarre, crazy case. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the exonerated five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107.
or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.